All right, welcome back to the North Star Method podcast, where we give you the mental skills to be at your best when it matters most. My name is Sebastian. I am the co-founder and CEO of North Star Performance Psychology.
My name is Sean, co-founder and director of mental performance.
And today on our 8th episode, we're bringing you another great guest to give you insights into the world of being a D1 college athlete. Let them know who you are.
My name is Kylie McCrae, and I was a D1 gymnast at Clemson University.
So what better place to start than with how you got into the sport? I guess just give us a little bit of your journey so far and where you're at now.
So I got into the sport because I was a crazy little kid and jumping on everything. And my mom was like, I need to put you somewhere safe where you can do all your crazy things. And then so I went to a gym and did like little mini me classes, and then eventually like started really liking doing gymnastics and kind of took it from there and took it really seriously.
What age would you say you started to take it more seriously than just kind of like jumping around?
Probably like 6, because I started at 4. Yeah. So I'd probably say like 6.
Yeah. I don't know if it's like a Florida thing. I did gymnastics till I was 5. Like, I feel like everybody does it, like kind of learning, but like those who stick with it, I guess, have a little bit of a different breed.
Yeah. Gymnastics is really good for body awareness, especially as a young kid. So
speaking of like that moment when it started to get more serious, I guess, when did you know that it was something you wanted to pursue further? Was it a passion-based thing? Was it just like people around here telling me I'm good at this?
I think a lot of it, especially when I was younger, was everybody was like, hey, you're really good at this. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then as I got older, I was just like, every time I get a new skill or do like went up in a different level, like it was kind of like addicting. And I was like, I really like this. I want to keep doing it. So, and then I saw all the college girls and was like, that's my goal, to get to college.
Yeah. So it's interesting. One thing that we talk a lot about with clients is this idea of like what your motivation is. And you talk about intrinsic or extrinsic motivation, and usually like you don't have that defined that early on. So the way that we think about it is like pleasure, passion, purpose. And most people day to day are motivated by pleasure. So that's biological and societal rewards, whether that's like labels and prestige or money or wanting things that are like primally important. And then we like to say that that's the reason that you see, you know, guys will get drafted in the NFL and then
Their car under the 50 miles.
Yeah, exactly.
That script.
Because they're still responding to that pleasure kind of motivation. Passion, obviously, it's like, I love this. It's partially like what you described in terms of like, I'm addicted to the process. I like what it feels like when I take a step up. And then purpose, hopefully, is like what transcends all of that. And that's what gets you through things when it gets hard, when the passion just isn't there. Hearing all of that, I guess, like, what has your experience been with your motivation and just why you did it in the first place?
Yeah, so I think as a kid, like, I would agree, more of like the pleasure aspect of it, like it was just kind of fun, and I was just like, this is a good way for me to get out my energy. And then, you know, I ended up loving it, especially as I got older. Like, you know, the more skills you get, the easier gymnastics gets, so the more you kind of love it because then it's kind of just like second nature. And then towards the end of it, like during recruiting, you're getting older, a lot of girls tend to lose the love for the sport. Like in JO, which is Junior Olympic is what it stands for. In JO, once you get to level 10, it's kind of like that's where you stop and you just continue at level 10 until you go off to college or you can go off to elite and stuff like that. But I think once I kind of lost a little bit of the love for the sport, I had like an event happen in my life where I changed my love for the sport, like losing that to I get to do things that a lot of people can't do. Mm-hmm. I get to follow out my dreams and I get to do what I want to do. And not everybody has that option. So that was kind of my why for the sport changed, just because, you know,
where everybody can. Sorry, where along that journey's timeline did that like change happen?
So the event happened when I was 15. And then I think once I wrapped my head around it, everything like that, once I got to 16, 17 is when I was like, I don't get to take this for granted. So. Mm.
So that's kind of interesting, especially from like at that time you're in high school and then you start to be in college at kind of the highest level. I mean, this past year, your last year, y'all went to like the playoffs, right? Was
yeah.
Round two?
Round two of regionals, yes.
Round two of regionals.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, for the, I guess for the non-gymnastics watchers out there, what does that exactly mean? You know?
So we have, it depends on your conference. I mean, every conference has regionals and nationals, but like ours was called ACCs. You'd have SECs or whatever other conferences there are. Pac-10, stuff like that. So you would go to your conference, whoever wins the conference, like they're just conference champs. The top 36 teams ranked go to regionals. Some teams are seeded, some teams aren't. So if you're seeded, you know you're going to round two. If you're not seeded, you have to play into round one most of the time and then have to make it to round two. So our first year at Clemson Gymnastics, we didn't make it to round two, but I made it individually. So I went on my own without like the rest of my team. Yeah.
And you were representing Clemson,
right? Yes. So we had competed the day before with as our team, lost in day one. So then the other team made it. And then me and three other girls made it as individuals. But we were like kind of spread out between teams.
That's interesting. So you can move forward in the tournament without a team.
Correct. Yeah. You can go forwards even all the way up until nationals without your team.
So what would happen like in that sense? And pardon my ignorance. If you were to like win the nationals event, but your team didn't get there, like would Clemson still win or would it just be you? What?
It would just be me as a Clemson gymnast. So like if I was winning beam at nationals, it would be Kyla McCrae, the Clemson gymnast.
So there's a kind of like dilemma that almost all team sport athletes have, which is that, yeah, you're on a team and you have a collective goal of, you know, advancing, getting to some kind of tournament, winning a championship, but also everybody as an individual has goals that don't always align. And, you know, people try to go to culture. They want to say that their team's like a family. And at the same time, it's like, hey, you know, the person next to you could be holding you back. And then that applies in day-to-day life too, right? Like even in families or at work, like certainly there are situations where you're trying to be part of a unit, but also you have to focus on yourself. How did you kind of balance that?
So in gymnastics, it's kind of funny because you're always in a team, but it switches between JO to college. So in JO, you're more individual because you're fighting for that college scholarship and you're fighting for yourself and you're trying to get recruited. When you get to college, it's all about your team. Like, yes, it's about you, but you do things for your team. Like if somebody goes up ahead of me and they fall, like I have to have their back. I have to make this routine to make sure that, you know, we still do good on the event. So it was more individual earlier on in life for me than it was later on in life because it was more of just like a team aspect.
Now, I imagine the pressures that come with that feel a little bit different, especially like trying to get recruited versus just wanting to be there for your team. Could you speak to that a little bit if possible?
Yeah, I mean, getting recruited, I think, for any sport is going to be incredibly stressful. And with gymnastics, when I was doing it, like some of my friends had been recruited like when they were in eighth grade, and then the rule changed. So then I wasn't able to be recruited until June 15th before my junior year of high school. So it was kind of like completely different for like I was in the middle of when the rule changed and everything. So like I had a friend who had committed by eighth and ninth grade and I was in the same level. And then like a couple months after that rule changed. So it's definitely stressful. And then also like it's kind of funny because you're all at the same gym. You're all trying to get recruited. And a lot of there's not many gymnastic schools, especially D1. Like you're all trying to kind of get recruited by the same people. So it's like you're fighting your teammates at the same time. And it's hard because you want to make sure you're doing well at the meets for the coaches. But if you put that external pressure on yourself, you're going to crumble. So
how do you find yourself not putting that external pressure on yourself? What is kind of a way to deal with that?
I don't think I did a very good job of it when I was trying to get recruited, but I think in college I found a way to be like not so I'm someone who's a perfectionist, and that's what gymnastics is a lot about, is perfectionism. And I had to find a way to be like go up and have fun. Like especially in my last few beam routines that I did, I told myself just have fun with it. Like I would have to tell myself it doesn't matter, because if I told myself like I need to make this dream routine, I would get so in my head. So I would go off to the side while everybody was competing, and I would do my own thing and kind of just like stay in my own head and just be like, it's just for fun. Like, that's literally what you're in college for. Like, it's, you love the sport, it should be fun. So I had to tell myself that there's no pressure and that I should just be having fun with it.
Yeah. And you know, you hear it a lot, the just pressure, and we love to see people rise to the occasion in pressure situations. But something that people don't talk about is just how vulnerable sports actually are, right? Because you're putting yourself in a position to be judged, like, objectively. And this is happening for college athletes and high school athletes at a time where they're still trying to develop their idea of themselves. Mm. And so, you know, we talk so much about going inside out instead of outside in, meaning, you know, do I look to feedback in the outside world, labels, what school I went to, what grades I'm getting, et cetera, to inform my idea of myself? Or do I define what I value, how I want to show up, what I want my life to feel like first, and then let everything else be a byproduct of that? So how does being in those kind of vulnerable situations and like knowing that you're getting judged impact you at such an important part of your life? And I guess, what was your experience with that? Any advice for anybody else dealing with that?
Yeah, I think... I can really only speak to gymnastics specifically, but for gymnastics is the whole point of gymnastics is you're getting judged. The higher the score, the better, right? So they're judging everything from your toes to your hair. Like,
yeah,
if your hair is out of place, they could take a point off if they wanted to, or a tenth off, or whatever.
That's...
Because it is crazy. It's kind of up to the, like, that was more in JO. At college, it's a little different. The judging and scoring is a little different. But, like, genuinely, it's up to the judge's discretion. If the judge is biased and you have a red label on and they don't like red, you could have less points just because of that. So it's been really hard for me to kind of balance like who I am outside of a perfectionist gymnast with like who I am as myself, as just like Kylan, you know? And I don't know if I've really quite found that balance yet. But being judged your entire life definitely makes you, one, look at yourself differently, and two, kind of look at the world a little bit through a smaller lens.
There's a lot to think about there, I'm sure. Like, I'm sure before, like, an event, you're thinking about, what is the judge going to think? Like, is he going to appreciate my aesthetic beyond just the execution of the routine? There's so much that's so, like, I guess, facilitative of overthinking. It almost seems like, who the fuck cares is kind of the mindset you want to go into, right? Beth, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah, I mean... That was kind of what I had to tell myself at that point, because I was like, I know I'm going to get up there and do my best. And if my best that day means I don't do the greatest beam routine, that's going to have to be okay, because I already did it. And so I can't go back and change it. So all I can do is go up there and do my best. And if it's not your day, it's not your day. You have to be okay with that.
I find a lot of times that is like the essence of high performance, is like letting go of the need to have an outcome and just trying to actually go out there and have fun. Also, like you mentioned, examples we've talked about on the show before, like Scottie Scheffler, but really you can look in any sport and just kind of find, like, if you can go out there and have fun and reconnect to the reason that you'd started doing the sport and started to thrive in it in the first place, oftentimes if you can keep that connection, then the rest falls into place a lot easier.
Right. Yeah, I think it's, I mean, with just kind of having the sport of gymnastics, like, it's a very tough sport to be in. You're competing against people always, like, even in college gymnastics, there's only 6 lineup spots. So you're competing against the other 20 teammates to make it into the top 6, and only 5 count. So it's like, you're always competing against somebody and trying to make yourself better. And when you do have that not great outcome, you get, oh my gosh, my lineup spot going to be taken away. Like, that's scary, especially for me as a one event gymnast in college. Like, my whole identity was wrapped around whether I was going to compete beam or not. So it was definitely challenging.
I think that's probably the place that most athletes get stuck, whatever level they're at. It's like, do they get really caught up in like what this means and what's at stake? And so we'd like to get really like granular with what are the moment-to-moment things that you can do to get back to that sense of like play and just loving the sport. I mean, most of the time when we hear like people who have the yips or people who they're choking under pressure, the relief on the other side, it's always described as, yeah, I went out there and I did it like I used to when I was a kid, right?
Right.
But you hear that and it's like, how do you actually do that? So were there any specific like practices? Were there things that you told yourself to kind of shift back into that sense of having fun?
I think the biggest thing I did was enjoy the moment more. Like before, I was really to myself. Like if people were like, I was a lot of the times later in the lineup on beam. So the girls that were going before me, I wasn't watching. I was turned around. I had my ears plugged, like all of that. And in that, I'm in silence. I'm with myself and I'm kind of just like stuck there. And so like I could go into my head. So I think what did help me more this season was I enjoyed the moment, because I also did know that it was going to be my last season and I didn't want to just not be present in the moment. So I enjoyed the moment and I was there cheering for my teammates, watching them, seeing how they did. Because before, if I saw somebody fall or do something like not great, I'd be like, oh crap, like I have to now take on the responsibility of doing the best beam routine I can. So I think just like sitting there and being like, if somebody fell before me, I'd be like, that really sucks, but I'm going to go out there and do my best. And my best is all that I can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, we often find it's a counterintuitive thing. If you want to have a good result, like obviously we play sports and we compete to do well. A lot of times overthinking and kind of worry about the need to do well, it kind of bottlenecks access to our physical resources because of this mental blockage and we can't execute. So we find that caring less about the result ultimately yields a better one, and it's such a tricky thing. Like you still can't be just like mind, like just thinking about the result, but you have to be thinking, I have to go out there and just have fun and do my thing. And again, like with that team aspect and that culture of being a good teammate and needing to make up for the faults maybe of the others, I figure that it's just got to be hard sometimes. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's, again, like you guys said, like a lot of pressure on you, right? When I did care and I would be like, I have to make this beam routine, 9 times out of 10, I was not making that beam routine. Like when I got up there and been like, you know what, like my ACC's beam routine, somebody had fell before us or before me and I was last. And my coach was like, you got me, right? And that moment I was like, ooh, like I have to actually do this. And then I was like, wait, no, I don't. Because if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. I know I'm going to do my best. And so I made that flip of the switch really quickly in my brain. And then I did literally the best routine of my life. So,
wow.
So there's a situation where, you know, and obviously at a program like this, look, you have great coaches. But also, you know, I wonder in that moment, like, how would it have been different if it was just like, I know you got me versus like, you got me, right? Like,
yeah. I think... I mean, honestly, if I think about it, just the way that my brain works is I feel like if she said, I know you got me, I'd be like, oh my God, there's a lot of pressure on this. Like, she knows that I can do it. Like, what if I don't? So I think her saying, like, you got me, right? I was like, hell yeah, I do. Like, flipped, switch, go. Like, I think that, for me, my brain works that way better.
I mean, yeah, it's to each their own. We find that. Sometimes these like tiny little semantic changes or the change in the language, even like in our own internal dialogue, can be very helpful. We often tell like our clients, for example, talk to yourself after a mistake as if you would like talk to a teammate or a friend, because you would often find that you talk to a teammate or a friend a lot nicer and be able to help them out of that place when really you deserve the same kind of treatment. That's funny to hear that the framing of it that's almost more like interrogative, like questioning, is more so the one that resonates with you because it applies less pressure.
Whenever I had like an expectation put on me, that's when I was like, oh, I really have to do this well. And if I didn't have an expectation on me, then I was like, okay, I'm good. Because if somebody was like, I need you to do this, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can. And that's where the internal dialogue, which I've struggled with my entire life, where I'm like, wait, like, I don't know if I can do that. Or, oh my gosh, now there's so much pressure on me. And so I think for me, the way that she had phrased that, she like grabbed my hand and she was like, you got me, right? And I was like, uh-oh. And then I was like, wait, no, I don't. I'm like, yes, I do. I'm like, I got you, you know?
Yeah, that's the voice in our head can be really funny, and understanding like why it's there can be very important. We've discussed this before, like evolutionarily, it's to kind of protect you and keep you safe. And in this moment, the safety might be like not messing up on the beam or something, and being able to effectively like play devil's advocate, kind of play lawyer, challenge that automatic mind oftentimes can get us realizing what it is that we need to do. Like, oh shit, I don't know if I can do this. Like, maybe they're not even expecting me to be completely perfect here. They just need me to do my best.
Yeah.
And that's probably what she means.
That's, I mean, that was kind of like the entire thing, especially this season, is like, we don't need you to be perfect. We just need you to do your best, because your best is enough.
Yeah.
And so.
That's a huge message, right? Because like, mm-hmm. you could argue that that's something that people are missing just in their daily lives too, right? It's this idea of like, nothing I do is enough, so I always have to do more to be okay. And again, so much of psychology is counterintuitive. It's like, really, in order to do more, you have to understand that whatever to do is already enough. All of these things, right, like we know them, but it seems like for most individuals, they need all of this time and experience to figure it out themselves. Do you think that it's possible to teach, like, if you're a young gymnast watching this, could you distill that experience and get them to that place sooner? Or is it just something that you have to go through yourself?
I think going through it is extremely helpful. But I think that, like, I think this is might be with any athlete, but especially gymnastics, when you get into that competitive setting, you're like, I need to do more. And when you do more, like, if you do more on a cast handstand, you're over the bar, you're on the floor. So it's like, or if you do more on the beam, you're going to fall off. If you do more on the floor, you're going out of bounds. Like, there's always something, like, if you do more than what you're used to, it's going to feel so different and you're going to do something completely different. But if you just go in there and you're like, this is a practice, do it like you do it in practice, there's nothing to worry about, which was like the biggest mind shift that a lot of us had to do this year on my team was just, it's just like practice. We don't need to do any more. We don't need to do any less. We just need to do our normal.
Call that trusting your training.
Yes, yeah. Trust your training.
Because a lot of times we do find, like, when the pressure's on and we're a little bit, like, dysregulated, we're not in our kind of sweet spot of composure, you're wanting to, like, do everything you can when really you're overextending. Find this in, like, really all sports. Like you said, you make unnecessary adjustments. You do too much often, and you don't do what you're used to doing and what you've trained to do perform. So that's really, really insightful, Ashler.
Speaking of experience, this is like my favorite question to ask any athlete, which is, especially somebody who has accomplished as much as you have, if you could go back to like when it all started and give yourself some advice or just tell yourself something, what would it be?
Don't take everything so seriously.
So you had that, like, that was there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that was quick.
Like, I would just say, don't take everything so seriously. I was so, it was funny because I was never a perfectionist until I got to college. And my mom would like be like, doesn't it kill you that it's not perfect? And I'm like, no, I did my best. Like, that's whatever. And then, like, I think doing that throughout JO was almost not even helpful, because it was like, I had to learn it quickly in college, and then I became this perfectionist person that I had never been before in my life until like later in high school into college. And I felt like a completely different person, that was like, nothing was ever good enough. So I would say, like, continue that little kid mindset where I was just like, you know what, I did my best, you know, just don't take everything so seriously.
Yeah, we really encourage people to find words that can define the mindset and the feeling of the way that you want to show up, right? And for you, describing it as that kid mindset, right? Just play, and it's very free. I think just having words for that and being able to say that can almost be like a trigger to get back in to that state. Something else I'm curious about, just in the vein of perfectionism, because that's a huge topic in high performance. I wonder if you noticed any interaction between, like, when you were experiencing more perfectionism in the sport, like, if there was any influence on your life outside of the sport with that. Like, for example, I've noticed that, especially in, like, building this business, you know, there's no roadmap. There's no other example of exactly what we're trying to do here. And so I could spend more time just trying to get this one font perfectly right or figure out the exact way that we're going to describe what we're doing. And when I worked on just getting back to looking at it as not like a business, but almost like an album, like an artist creating an album. It's like you don't show up and be like, I'm going to do 5 songs today, right? You just go and create. Then I also noticed in my personal life, like I didn't need to organize all of my stuff in my room as much. And so I don't know if you ever had anything like that where you noticed that relationship.
I think mine might have been a little bit of an opposite switch because I went from not caring to being like perfectionist. So I did notice the switch. I mean, my mom was always very like hard on grades and stuff. But I was like, I did my best. Now in college, I would call her freaking out, like, I'm going to fail this exam. I'm going to get a C in the class or something like that. And so I think schooling, it definitely changed my views on that. And then I think towards the end of college, I'm really not like a clean person. That's how actually sounds horrible. That sounds terrible. Yeah. Like,
organized?
Thank you. Yeah, organized. I'm not an organized person. My bad. But like I noticed I would clean my room a lot more often. Things weren't like in high school, like I had things all over my desk and I didn't care. But like when I got to college and like, you know, had to live with people and stuff like that, like, and became the more perfectionist, I started cleaning my room more often and I was more organized and I had things put away instead of just like a big junk drawer like on a desk. Like I noticed it there too. But
so now that you've been out of college for a few months and the sport's been away from you, what's like the status of your perfectionistic tendencies?
Quite low right now, honestly. I think like in certain things there are still things that I want to be perfect, like with Barbas, like I want to learn everything I can and I want to do things right. So like that, I still have a huge identity and perfectionism there with work, but I think outside of work, I mean, my room's clean, so that's a plus. I think that just became a habit at this point. But I think outside of that, like I just had hip surgery and gymnastics has been so focused on body image and I can't exercise as I normally would right now. So it's like a very different shift and normally I would be freaking out, but I'm actually okay with it. So
yeah, that's really good to hear. And we find perfectionism can be like a helpful trait because it could take you really far. It's very similar to like one of the big 5 personality traits, conscientiousness, which for those you don't know, that pretty much means just wanting to do well and wanting to do work that you're proud of and do it very well. That is a really high driver of like success. Now, the perfectionism can start to border on like the neurotic side of it, which neuroticism just being like proneness to overthinking, anxiety. I'm wondering now, as you are kind of trying to develop your identity after being a gymnast, kind of where that balance could lie for you in a healthy place, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. I am a chronic overthinker. Like, I'll think about anything, like the best case scenario, worst case scenario, and everything in between with anything I do, like even driving to work. Like simple things like that. I'm a chronic overthinker. So that's very present in my life too. But I think the biggest thing would be like finding myself outside of being a gymnast and outside of being like things like that. That would be my bigger thing.
Mm-hmm. So what got me into this field was interest in injury recovery for myself. Obviously injuries can look a lot different with normal athletes or more typical like athletic injuries, I should say. What's your experience been? I know you're recovering from a hip surgery now, with injuries throughout your career.
Well, my first injury was I fractured my growth plate in my wrist and I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. I think I still have the cast. I was like so excited to be in a cast. I don't really know why. Now I
sounds obviously like,
yeah.
It's about it. Like guys saw it.
I've always wanted to, I've never broken a bone besides my neck.
Please knock on wood.
Yeah, but yeah. Sorry, mean to have that one.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Yeah, no, I mean, as a little girl, I was like, I wanted to be injured. It was the weirdest thing. But anyway, so yeah, my first one was a wrist. And then I had broken my foot a few times, my ankle. I was in an elbow cast at one point. I don't remember what for. I don't know what I did, but I was in double cast. Like, I've been cast everywhere. And then my first, like, major injury, I was in eighth grade, and I completely tore my labrum at my hip, and then had...
It's our whole audio to AVM things. It's RCM.
My, like, first major injury, I was in eighth grade, and I tore my labrum at my hip, and then I had a cam and a pincer, like, on my femur. So what I think, don't quote me on this, I'm not a medical doctor at all, and I don't know if this is right at all, but I think, like, my femur was like this instead of being, like, round. So it was kind of, like, had little lesions on it. So I got a bone marrow transplant first to try and see if that would fix my hip. So they took it out of my spine and then put it into my hip. It didn't work. So then I ended up getting surgery in eighth grade, recovered from that. That was a really long recovery, like 9 months to a year, I think. And then my, right before my junior year of college, not college, of high school, I completely exploded my elbow. So then I got Tommy John surgery. And that was like kind of my second major injury. And then after that, I had a really bad ankle sprain, I think, which is so funny because ankle sprains sound like so silly, but they actually hurt so bad.
Oh, they're serious.
Yeah, they're very serious. So I had a really, really bad ankle sprain and was taken out for the rest of the season that year as well. That was my senior year of college or high school. And then college, I did pretty good managing injuries, a few like little things, but nothing big. And then towards the end, I just had to get surgery on my hip again because I had retore the labrum and had another lesion on my femur. So,
a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Tons of injuries.
And especially in kind of like big points in your career, what are the kind of like biggest mental hurdles or challenges that you had to deal with like in those most impactful moments?
I think when I was younger, trying to figure out things that I could still do while being injured was hard. I had a lot of guidance, so that helped a lot. But I think that was kind of like the biggest thing was like, okay, what can I still do to like try and make myself better? Once I got older, the biggest mental hurdle was now I'm injured. I can't work out as much. And gymnastics, it was so body image based that I was so scared of like, you know, gaining weight or something like that. So that was like the biggest hurdle was like trying to find the right nutrition, the right exercise balance, what I could do, what I couldn't do without, you know, it kind of turning into something more, which eventually it ended up doing my senior year. But once I got it with that, it was okay.
Yeah. So a lot more just like fine tuning of like how to get over it. In those times where you were injured, a lot of times you find people feeling isolated because they're not contributing to their team, like they're not doing the things that they're used to doing. What was your experience with that? And if so, like, how were you able to kind of stay connected to the team if you were able to?
Yeah, I think this year is a perfect example of that. This is my first year ever in college where I had gone to a meet and wasn't in lineup. So for the 3 years that I was in college before, I was always in lineups, always competing. And then this year, once my hip started getting really bad, I couldn't go up. I mean, I knew if I went up, I would fall, and there's no point in getting up if you're going to do that. So, like, I think being on the sidelines for the first time was so incredibly, like, hard for my brain to comprehend. Because I was sitting there, like, I should be on the beam right now. Like, it's the beam, like, beam rotation and everybody's competing and I'm sitting there like, this is crazy. I've never not been at a competition where I've had to be focused and like on beam. And it's not like I wasn't focused, but it's just like I didn't have the pressure of getting on the beam and doing a beam routine. And so I did feel bad because there was a lot of my own self-talk where I was like, well, I'm not contributing, so like why do I really matter right now? And so that was like something I had to get over, because even though I'm not physically contributing, I'm still a big part of the team. Like, I, as silly as it sounds, like I help with vault settings and like in the warm-ups, and I help on bars and even on floor doing mats and like sting mats for girls. So it's not like I didn't have a place. It's just not my normal place that I was in. And it was hard to kind of mentally wrap around that.
Yeah. In those moments, you kind of have to adjust like what your success looks like, because like what the wins are. Like, if I can actually successfully like coach a teenager, like guide them through some issue, like that's a win.
Yeah, that was like our biggest thing is like, okay, if you're not competing and you're not in lineup, you better be the best teammate you could possibly can be. So that's kind of where like I shifted and I was like, all right, well, if I can't physically be on the beam, I can cheer for them and I can root for them and be as helpful as I can be. So
if you are an athlete who is about to exit your sport, whether you're graduating or retiring, you need to think about your identity separate from being an athlete. And we were discussing this feeling of like, you know, who am I if I'm not contributing, right? And then the downstream effect of that being like how you talk to yourself in those moments, like you're injured, you can't compete and contribute the way that you're used to. How does that relate back to expanding your sense of who you are and being like, well, look, I'm not just a competitor, I'm a teammate. And now in this next phase of life, you know, maybe I'm a guide or a mentor or an inspiration to other people. How, I guess the question is, how does self-talk relate to filling in those other parts of who you are?
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny because I am a mentor for some younger gymnasts right now. And I always tell them what I wish I would have heard or what I wish I would have done is use like positive self-talk. Because if you tell somebody, don't think of a pink elephant, they're going to think of a pink elephant.
One of my favorite analogies.
Yeah, I use that all the time. So like trying to switch their brains, like, okay, what's a more positive way to say this? Like, I might not be getting this right now, but I will get it in the long term or something like that, right? So I think I've had to figure out how to do that with myself because, I mean, like, I tie everything kind of back into the same thing. It's just what my experience is. But I think, like, especially with, I mean, just being growing up as, I mean, a woman and, like, a gymnast and having the body image and everything, like, I had to, like, I always thought it was so silly to, like, sit in the mirror and be like, you are beautiful. Like, yeah. I always thought that was silly, but, like, honestly, it's what I had to do to, like, get myself to a place where my brain wasn't so toxic to myself. And so I think even getting older is still something that's extremely important to continue doing, whether you're an athlete or not, and trying to find yourself, okay, I was Kylan the gymnast, now who am I? Mm-hmm. Like, now I'm just Kylan, and that can be okay too, but what do I stand for? What are my morals? What do I want to portray?
It's so funny because it's like so many of these things that are profoundly valuable practices. At first, they seem cliche or silly, but if you make it like a physical analogy, right, it's crazy to think that just doing squats can like extend your lifespan, right? It's like, how is this one motion so far reaching in the quality of my life over time? And you're touching on affirmations, right? Like having these beliefs and statements that we repeat to ourselves in those key moments, which a lot of times it's like, am I really like talking to myself right now? But I mean,
it's for
being like in the hardest parts of my life, like in the morning, I've got up. You're also in a brainwave state where you're much more impressionable. You're priming your focus as to what it's going to be looking for throughout the day. And I would look in the mirror and be like, you've done harder things than this. This is going to make you the person that you need to be to have the impact that you want to have. So I appreciate that you could share that with people because it's just another vote for those silly, simple things can be absolutely game changing. Speaking of things that change the game.
Oh, that's good job.
Yeah, I was sitting on that. The landscape of college sports is changed forever, whether we like it or not. Most people don't. NIL is altering the motivation that athletes have for what they do. It's changing which schools have advantages or disadvantages as to the talent that they can attract. You got a front row seat to watching that transition. What was your experience with that? And what advice would you give to gymnasts or athletes entering the NIL landscape now?
So I think that at first it was really exciting and everyone was like, oh my gosh, I can make money off of my name, image, and likeness. This is incredible, right? And I think it was at first really great. I think now what it's kind of transitioning into, I don't know if I totally love the fact that schools can like necessarily pay payers to like come to their school. I don't know if I totally enjoy that aspect of it. But then again, I mean, it's kind of challenging to speak on, but I don't know if I think it's totally fair where I can be like, I'm going to give you 50 grand to come to Clemson, but I'm going to give you five. you know, just because of your athletic ability, which, I mean, that's kind of with scholarships too, but it's just, I don't know. For me, I would rather like everybody kind of be, you're not allowed to get paid to like come to a school.
Right.
But that's just my own.
It's a good thing because like you think like you're an adult, you should be able to like profit off of yourself, right?
Yeah.
Your innate image and likeness. Like it's crazy that that can be restricted. That was how what I thought my whole life. And then when the whole NIL thing changed, I was like, okay, this is probably for the better. It's like more, you know, agency for the athletes and the players. We found now that it's kind of gone too far and it's become disproportional. People like won't go to schools for less than $100,000 a year.
Yeah, which is wild, especially if it's like, oh, my dream school's been Florida my whole life. And they're like, well, we're only going to give you 10 grand or we're not going to give you any money. But Alabama's giving you $200,000. Are you going to go with your dream or are you going to go with the place you're going to get more money? And, you know, like that's kind of a decision you have to make. I was not in that position. But I think for me, like NIL was so exciting at first and it was like, oh, my gosh, like this is cool. But even now, like not even like talking about the getting paid to play somewhere, I think NIL is almost unfair in the fact that a lot of brands, and there are some brands that are doing good with this, but a lot of people and a lot of brands only care about people with followers, or they only care about people with like a big name and stuff like that. And that makes it hard because NIL is supposed to be accessible to all college athletes. And when you have somebody with 2,000 followers versus somebody with 100,000 followers, nobody's ever going to want to work with this person with 2,000 followers because they just don't think it's going to help their brand as much. So then those people don't get the NIL opportunities. And that was me for a while. And then somehow I got really lucky and my Instagram blew up and then I was able to get more NIL deals. But it always kind of felt unfair because it was just like, well, why didn't I get these opportunities when I was at 4,000 or 5,000 or 1,000 at that point?
We
you know?
Are still as good at the job.
Exactly. Like my value as myself didn't change. It was just my value of my social media presence, which is hard.
It sounds like now more than ever, athletes need to be aware of how their motivation is going to be impacted by NIL. And going back to the beginning of the episode, this idea that if you respond to those societal rewards, that's not going to last you when it gets hard, right? And so that's why you see the transfer portal being such a big deal and people, you know, skipping out and nobody's really building a culture anymore. You have to have a more profound reason for why you do what you do than just following the money. Otherwise, when it gets hard, you know, you're not going to last. You know, that being said, it does sound like on one hand, there is more agency and more empowerment for players, but as with all of the business of sports, that's usually a front for the organizations and schools and to take advantage of it. And so one thing that we like to say is that, you know, almost every team has sports at colleges. Almost no athletes go talk to them. And the reason is because it's pretty clear that we're waving this thing in front of your face saying it's for you. But at the end of the day, they work for us. And if we ask them what you said, they're gonna tell on you.
Yeah.
So North Star is for the players. We like to think that the people that we bring into this community are for the players too. And it sounds like that is a fundamental part of your stance on this as well. Just that, you know, you have to find a way to maximize it for yourself, even though it's not fair. And then also the idea of like, well, we're not investing in people anymore because it's like, I'm not going to, you know, give you anything until you have what I want, even though you were poised to be where you are now. And if somebody had just identified that earlier, right? I mean, that could be a good investment for now.
I think just like in general, NIL has changed my life. It's given me incredible opportunities I never thought I would have. I just wish the opportunities were fair for everyone and it didn't totally depend on your social media presence or how many followers you have. And I would say for my advice is, when if you want to build your followers and you want to do that, I think I got a little lucky, but find something you are passionate about. I love mental health. I try to post mental health on my Instagram. Like that's something I'm passionate about. I was reading something the other day where it was like what gymnasts in the NCAA space are, you know, mental health advocates, and somebody commented under it and was like, well, the only one I can think of is Conor McRae. And that was like, well, that's awesome because people are actually getting to see like that I'm putting that out there. So whether it's even posts or just like little story things that I see, like today it's Men's Mental Health Month, like, you know, like just putting that stuff on my stories, just saying like, hey, I'm an advocate, like if you need me, I'm here. So
it sounds like the key to thriving in the NIL environment, not only is it to define your motivation and your why for playing the sport that you do, but the other side of that coin is that you get to know yourself and figure out what your passions are, what's the things that you want to use your platform for. And then when you express that authentically, people respond to that. No question that overall the landscape has made it a little bit unfair, but we like to say that we can give people an unfair advantage in a different way, and that's through training mental skills.
Like, great transition.
You're on fire.
You guys really are.
What has your experience with mental performance been? And, you know, what advantage do you think it can give people in their sport and in their life too?
Yeah, I think I got lucky. The gym I went to for club gymnastics, we did mental performance once a month, sometimes twice a month. Like, we were very lucky. It was built into our schedule. We had 30 minutes with our mental performance coach, and we did worksheets and we did games with each other, and we always set goals and stuff like that. So I think having that as a younger girl was extremely helpful for me to like set my eyes on the prize almost. And then also gymnastics is, I mean, there's a lot of fears in gymnastics. I was lucky to get over my fears at a younger age. But like, using a mental performance coach to help you get over fears like that. Like, I had a fear of, we had something called like a trench bar, and it was probably like a 2-foot jump, but I didn't want to jump over it. Like, I was so scared, or I was scared to jump to the high bar. And so using my mental performance coach, she was able to really help me get over those fears while showing me that like, hey, this isn't an irrational fear and you shouldn't feel like bad for having it. It's very normal. But this is how you can get over it, and this is how you're going to be safe. And a lot of gymnastics is, you know, staying safe. A lot of girls are scared of getting injured and stuff like that, right? So I think that was kind of like really, really helpful. And then just throughout college, even, we had mental performance coaches. And just one thing, I mean, I learned is like growth mindset. Like, that's something so simple, but nothing that I didn't know that until I went into college, like what a growth mindset really was. And like, how you can switch your internal thinking. And I think that's like the biggest thing for sports and how you succeed and get to the next level is if your internal talking is good, most likely your external sports and skills and whatever you're doing, you're playing, is going to be at a level higher than anyone else could be if they're beating themselves down every day.
For sure. And it sounds like you said you got lucky, like having it at this like young developmental age. We know we're younger. We're more sponges for information. Like the stages of cognitive development show this. The more you're able to kind of learn these skills and these tools and these strategies at an age where you're more impressionable, the more you're able to implement them and kind of self-develop them even throughout the rest of your career. So yeah, it sounds like you did have a good experience with that.
Yeah, I definitely think starting young is for sure the way to go.
If you are the parent or a coach of an athlete, or maybe you're an athlete, you wouldn't wait until high school or college to start lifting weights or stretching. So you definitely don't want to wait to start developing mental skills. And that's why NorthStar can provide mental skills training for people at any point in their athletic journey. The earlier, the better. That being said, I mean, I think by now it should be abundantly clear that, you know, being a D1 gymnast is an experience that from the outside might look one way, but from the inside can be extremely intense and also rewarding, whether it's your relationship to your own performance or your teammates, how you handle injury, what your identity is within or outside of the sport, and how you talk to yourself and believe in yourself. There's so much that you can do to change and raise the bar for the level of your performance. We want to thank you for being here today and for sharing your experience. It was super valuable. I don't think you realize how many people this will help. And I guess before we sign off, any other final thoughts or things that you want to plug?
Anyone you want to shout out?
I would just say, honestly, one, thank you guys for having me on. I had a blast. And I love being any type of voice for anyone, whether it helps one person or 100 people. I don't care. So I appreciate you guys for allowing me to come on. And if I honestly didn't have any mental performance coaching, I probably would not, I most likely would not have made it to the Division I level. So I am very grateful for that. So everybody check out North Star.
Appreciate it.
You are.
If you want to go D1, go North Star. You heard it here first.
Hell yeah.
We appreciate you for watching. If you want to support North Star in a no-cost way to you, you can like and subscribe to the North Star Method on Instagram, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or even Amazon, believe it or not.
I'm Bashan Tapesos.
That being said, we will see you next week.
We'll see you next week.
Peace.